When was the last time you sat down and devoted some time to writing a letter in longhand and on paper? Thanks to email, Twitter, and all the other alternative forms of communication technology has given us, letter writing is fast becoming a lost art. In his new study of letter writing called Yours Ever, novelist and critic Thomas Mallon takes a look at a type of writing that may soon be rendered as quaint as the quill pen. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
At first glance, Thomas Mallon's Yours Ever falls into the no-brainer category of new books. It's a study of the art of letter writing, and it's chock full of luscious quotes from the likes of marathon missive manufacturers like Teddy Roosevelt, George Sand, Mark Twain, Lord Byron, Flannery O'Connor, and Winston Churchill. Mallon himself brought out two earlier collections that are in the same vein as this one: A Book of One's Own, which was a study of diaries, and Stolen Words, about plagiarism. You see what I mean about no-brainer. Yours Ever promised to be such an affable literary entertainment that I almost passed it up. But what bumps this book out of the realm of the ho-hum is Mallon's own gift for unpredictable criticism. He is a canny reader of other writers' styles, and he confidently makes the kind of blunt pronouncements on other writers' personalities, as well as their work, that have become out of fashion in the relentlessly contextualized age of therapy and postmodern literary theory. For example, in a chapter that focuses on letters of complaint, Mallon turns his gaze on the British poet Philip Larkin, whose letters are filled with xenophobia, self-disgust, and scatological imagery, which doesn't mean that they aren't also sometimes very funny. Writing to a correspondent, Larkin compared the art of publishing a book to farting at a party. You have to wait till people stop looking at you before you can behave normally again. Mallon shrewdly points out that what former admirers of Larkin's who were dismayed by the posthumous publication of his letters really can't forgive about him, more than his unattractive prejudices, is that he was pissed off rather than righteously angry. That's such a smart insight. We don't mind our poets raging, but a poet whining on year after year about his noisy neighbors and bowel movements seems depressingly earthbound. As an appreciation of letters as a literary genre, Yours Ever is imbued with a sense of the form's 11th hour mortality. Email has all but vanquished what Mallon refers to as the small hardships of letter writing, having to think a moment longer, remaining in suspense while awaiting reply, having one's urgent letters cross in the mail. These are the things that enrich the art of letter writing, emotionally and rhetorically. Mallon tries not to be too sentimental. After all, writing letters can be a pain. But it's hard not to mourn the form when you're put in the private company of such masters as H.L. Mencken, Mary McCarthy, and Noel Coward. Describing a performance by the World War II-era British singer Deanna Durbin, Coward said that she sang "There'll Always Be an England" with tears rolling down her face as though she were bitterly depressed at the thought. In contrast, the letters Mallon quotes from Ayn Rand in a chapter he calls Advice fascinate precisely because of their lack of elegance. Mallon observes that the ugly, pile-driving clarity of Rand's writing was suited to the giving of advice, at least in those instances when the requestor needed someone else's certainty to pulverize hesitation. He then quotes from a letter that Rand wrote to her niece, who asked for the loan of $25 to buy a dress. Auntie Ayn stipulated a repayment plan and signed off thusly: "If you become ill, then I will give you an extension of time, but for no other reason. If when the debt comes due, you tell me that you can't pay, then I will consider you as an embezzler. I will write you off as a rotten person, and I will never speak or write to you again." Yours Ever is a revelatory collection of the nutty and the noble encased in correspondence. One small complaint I have is that I wish Mallon had more consistently identified the recipients of these gems. It helps to know whether the letters were indeed private or public performances. Otherwise, delving into this book offers readers the consolation that, even if email does delete the art of letter writing as we know it, there are still mountains of snail mail from the past to be opened up and savored.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Yours Ever, People and Their Letters by Thomas Mallon.
There's one more layoff at General Motors at the top of NPR's business news. This time it's the CEO. Fritz Henderson was asked to leave yesterday by the company's board of directors. The move comes 9 months after Henderson's predecessor was also forced out, that time by the government. Henderson had been under increasing pressure from GM's board, and in recent weeks, differences had surfaced between Henderson and GM's board chairman. The board chairman is the former AT&T executive the government brought in to help run the company, and he's going to take over as CEO for now. Michigan Radio's Tracy Samuelton has more on this surprise move and what's next for GM.
In March, the Obama administration's auto task force asked 25-year GM veteran Fritz Henderson to lead the automaker after forcing the resignation of Rick Wagoner. In a few months, Henderson steered GM through a perilous bankruptcy, shedding enough of the company's massive debt to make its survival possible. But his job ended yesterday, announced at a hastily arranged news conference. Henderson's boss, Ed Whitaker, the board chairman picked by the U.S. Treasury, is temporarily taking over. Whitaker says Henderson put GM on the right path.
But we now need to accelerate our progress toward that goal, which means a return to profitability and repaying the American and Canadian taxpayers as soon as possible.
Whitaker says he'll explain the decision in more detail in a few days. So it remains speculation if it was the sluggish sales or the big third quarter loss or the timetable for paying back some of the government's $50 billion investment. Jim Hall is with the consulting firm 2953 Analytics. He thinks whatever the reason, it was probably inevitable.
In a lot of ways, Fritz Henderson was the man who was born to get GM through a bankruptcy. And I mean that actually, that's praise, and it's significant praise. And he did it.
Hall says what Henderson is not is the big picture person with big ideas that GM now needs. Consultant Sheldon Stone is with the restructuring firm Amherst Partners. He speculates GM might go for an auto outsider, someone who can fix the automaker the way former Boeing chief Alan Mulally fixed Ford.
Growing up professionally in the automobile industry isn't necessarily a prerequisite to success in the CEO seat.
Other analysts think maybe GM needs an insider, but one with a reputation for shaking things up, such as GM's marketing chief Bob Lutz. Whoever it is has to be in it for more than the money. The federal government has slapped a $500,000 salary cap on the job. Stone says maybe Ed Whitaker should stay on permanently.
I wouldn't be surprised if the search led right back to him.
Analyst Jim Hall thinks not. But for now, Ed Whitaker, the former CEO of AT&T, is in charge of a car company, a big car company. Hall hopes he listens to the engineers and designers remaining at GM because they have the great ideas and a deep understanding of the auto industry. He says the good news is they're all working for a smaller and healthier organization.
GM now is a company that's totally transformed. It's slashed its debt, its operating costs, and a lot of its labor costs have been slashed. They have great product in the pipeline. They have great product in the market. It's GM's game to lose.
Today, GM hopes to play that game to win at the Los Angeles Auto Show, where the company will unveil a small car, the Chevy Cruze, and the Chevy Volt, an electric extended-range car that could, if it's successful, start to convince people that GM has changed, and for the better. For NPR News, I'm Tracy Samuelton in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Federal housing authorities have cracked down on a home lender responsible for more than 1,000 loans gone bad. The Federal Housing Administration, or FHA, insures home loans, but has seen defaults go up. NPR's Tamara Keith has more on yesterday's move.
In recent months, Lend America has aggressively gone after customers with ads like this one. Call Lend America right now. Hundreds of mortgage specialists are standing by.
But the company's FHA loans defaulted at more than double the national average. This week, the FHA pulled Lend America's approval to make government-backed loans, essentially shutting the company down.
Making sure that this company cannot continue to behave the way it does and prey on consumers in the way they have.
That tough talk comes from FHA Commissioner David Stevens. In a statement, Lend America said it is surprised and disappointed by the action and is reviewing its options. Stevens says the FHA plans to continue going after problem lenders.
We are looking at other institutions right now that we think are performing in a way that shouldn't be acceptable to anybody who looks at the mortgage business or looks at FHA.
Republican Congressman Scott Garrett says the FHA needs to tighten its lending standards, and closing down problem lenders isn't enough.
It should be done. Should have been done before, but it's just probably not going to be the factor that makes sure that their book is one that is sustainable.
Garrett has introduced a bill to require larger down payments on FHA loans. The agency currently requires only 3.5% down and has resisted changing that. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
It's said that the ancient Greek inventor Archimedes figured out how to calculate a metal's density. It was his famous Eureka moment. The king of Syracuse had asked him to find out if the royal crown was made of solid gold. More recently, Oakland teenager Mark Anthony Waters of Youth Radio has faced a similar quandary. In this case, the jewelry in question is not a royal crown, it's a dental one, a fitted gold tooth covering, known in hip-hop parlance as a grill.
The first time I wore my grill, I was given a presentation under a projector light. As soon as I started talking, everyone was like, "Ah, ah," and I was like, "What's wrong with you people?" And they said, "Your grill. It's blinding us." The grill blinded my mom, too.
Oh, my goodness, that is ugly. That's tacky. What purpose does it serve other than the, you know, shock, I guess, shock value or something?
Well, I wouldn't tell my mom this, but to me, the grill was like the ultimate symbol of masculinity. And secretly substituted for what I felt was my lack thereof. But then my mom said,
"Is that really real?"
Damn, my mom busted my bubble with that question. What if this thing is fake? I got even more worried about my grill when I talked to my coworker Orlando about his.
They implied when I bought the grill that it was real. They implied that it was 14 karat gold. And I knew there was something off because the top, my top grill and my bottom grill were a slightly different color, yellow gold. So I knew that, you know, there was something a little fishy going on.
So, seeking the VIP treatment, Orlando and I bypassed the pawn shop and head up the hill to UC Berkeley. We showed our grills to geologist Kent Ross.
Is today your first time seeing the grill?
Yes.
So I'll never come to UC Berkeley and find Kent Ross with the grill in his mouth?
I don't think so. I stay at home and read books a lot.
But he actually spends a lot of his time with an electron microscope. It looks like a small microwave. Ross sticks our grills inside, triggers the electron gun.
Electron beams make solid materials give off X-rays, and those X-rays tell you what elements are in the material.
And on a nearby computer screen, a series of peaks start to appear on a graph.
The bigger peaks are the more abundant elements. So the fact that the biggest peaks we see are the gold peaks indicates that there's a lot of gold in this area of this grill.
By this area, Ross means the grill surface. I want to know if the grill is solid gold. So Ross says we need to do a density test.
Okay, so I need to re-zero this.
It's an easy test. All we need to do is measure the weight of the grill in water, then in air, to find its density.
Density means weight per unit volume.
Then, Ross checks our results against gold's established density.
I'm going to go into my office and look in a book and find out what the density of gold and copper and silver are.
While the density of my grill reveals that it's 14 karat through and through, Orlando's is just a little too light.
It looks like there has to be some low-density, cheaper core inside of it, and that the gold coated on the outside.
I'm crushed. Nah, man, like, I don't know. Like, I thought that, like, I didn't believe those people at all. These gold teeth shops were selling solid gold grills. Like, you know, it is what it is. Fake it till you make it. Or just make it.
And now that I think about it, it would have been funny if my grill were fake. Like my alter ego dreams of transforming myself into a thug just because I got a grill. I realized using gold teeth of any kind, solid or plated, to change my life was ridiculous. I still don't want my intelligence assaulted by phony merchandise, but I'm no longer trying to prove my masculinity based on the things I buy or the sparkle off my smile. For NPR News, I'm Mark Anthony Waters.
Our program is directed by Greg Dixon, edited by Allison McAdam, and produced by Graham Smith. The technical director is Stu Rushfield. The engineering supervisor is Robert Jackson.
Our planning editor is Jerry Holmes. The staff includes Julia Buckley, Andrea Hsu, Gabe O'Connor, Carol Klinger, Chelsea Jones, Viet Le, and Rhonda Ray.
Our executive producer is Christopher Turpin. The managing editor for NPR News is David Sweeney. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Michelle Norris. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
In the early 90s, Disney won big at the box office with the film Cool Runnings, the story of the first Olympic Jamaican bobsled team. Well, another Jamaican winter sports story has been set into motion. Yesterday, a Jamaican dog musher named Newton Marshall began training outside Fairbanks, Alaska, for the 1,200-mile Iditarod race. And he's getting some top-flight coaching. His trainer is the three-time defending Iditarod champion Lance Mackey, who joins us from Fairbanks. Mr. Mackey, explain for us, please, how a guy from Jamaica ends up on a dog sled team.
Yeah, I've asked myself that question many a times, to tell you the truth. You know, I think it has a lot to do with just, you know, the public awareness of the sport. And like I said, you know, years ago, the bobsled team was kind of it was a hit. It was kind of a joke when it first came to the public's eye. And this is kind of the same way. Newton, when he was brought on to the sport, a lot of people thought it was just a publicity stunt and he wouldn't be around, you know, very long. Coming from Jamaica, of course, there's no snow, and the weather here in Alaska or Canada is pretty extreme, so most people didn't even think he had a chance, but he proved everybody wrong, and he's back now. He's finished the toughest race in the world, the Yukon Quest, and now he wants to attempt the Iditarod.
Well, when Newton Marshall is racing in Jamaica, how exactly is he doing that?
Well, they don't race over in Jamaica, actually, but he does have a dog sled tour business that he manages and operates. Basically, all it is a buggy, you know, with steering wheel and tires on it, and they've gathered up all the dogs around the streets and in the Humane Society and what have you, and put this team together, and they give rides to the tourists that show up in Jamaica.
Well, how would you describe Newton Marshall, this Jamaican, as a sled dog racer? How does he do?
Well, he does great. Like I said, he's already accomplished the Yukon Quest. He's just a bubbly kind of kid that, you know, everything you say to him, his answer is, yeah, man. you know, that's exciting. He's here to learn, and he knows this is maybe an opportunity that no other Jamaican will ever have.
Mr. Mackey, you're the son of a legendary sled dog racer. One of the founders of the Iditarod was your dad. Do you think he would look at this and say, oh, Lance, this is such a gimmick. What are you doing here?
Well, there is certainly people. I'm not saying my dad's one of them, but there are people that are saying exactly that. And yes, to a point, it's true. We are trying to get as much recognition for this sport as possible. The day he showed up, we was, you know, newspapers, TVs, radio stations. Everybody wants a part of this, and absolutely, it's going worldwide. We are getting some publicity over it, and that's, in my opinion, what it's all about.
Now, you're going to be racing against Newton Marshall, among others, in the Iditarod coming up, right?
Yes.
How do you think he'll do?
I have no doubt he's going to do just fine. My obligation is to get him to the starting line of the Iditarod. It's up to him. If he wants to take a leisurely trip to Nome, so be it. I'm not going to be disappointed with that.
Huh.
If he wants to be aggressive and race, he's going to have a team that I'm going to have a hard time outrunning.
Well, Lance Mackey, we wish both you and Newton Marshall the best of luck in the Iditarod coming up.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to it.
That's the three-time defending Iditarod champion Lance Mackey in Fairbanks, Alaska. He's training the Jamaican Newton Marshall for the Iditarod, which starts the first weekend in March.